This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you for a little more than 50 minutes talking literary things all around the world. We're going to start out with an interview from London or somewhere in the UK and wind up with some upcoming events in Nevada County and some happenings and very unfortunate happenings in Berkeley. I get all sorts of books sent to me from publishers who seem to think this is a good place to talk about them. And one that came a couple of months ago that intrigued me, I wasn't quite sure why, was a novel by the English novelist Hilary Mantel called Beyond Black. I'd heard her name, and it came with very high recommendations, so I decided to give it a try. But I'll admit that when I first got into it, 100 pages or so, I began to think, if this weren't required reading, do I really want to get into this? It is very bleak. It's supposed to be a comedy, but I haven't found anything really funny yet. It started out with a description of Southern England just after Christmas time, traveling the dank oily days after Christmas, the motorway, its wastes looping London, the margin scrub grass flaring orange in the lights, and the leaves of the poison shrubs striped yellow-green like a cantaloupe melon. 4 o'clock, lights sinking over the orbital road, tea time in Enfield, night falling on Potter's Bar, when there are nights when you don't want to do it, but you have to do it anyway. That's how it began, and as I said, it took me a while, but the farther in I got, the more I found that it was ghastly, it was depressing, but it was so well contrived and so funny. Hilary Mantel is on the phone now. Welcome to Booktown. Hello, Hilary. Oh, sorry, you could hear me, but I couldn't hear you. Yeah. Now, I don't know what you thought of my description of your book.
I could barely hear him.
Oh, okay. Well,
we're absolutely fine now.
Okay, I'll start out by just saying, at first I found it very depressing, and I wasn't sure if I really wanted to read all the way through. I felt very sympathetic toward one of the characters, Allison, but not very sympathetic toward Colette, the other one, and mm-hmm. It was pretty drab. But it soon turned into a ghastly comedy, and if I had to describe it to someone who didn't know your work, I think I might call it something of a mix between Graham Greene's Brighton Rock and Muriel Spark's Memento Mori, written by a very disillusioned Henry Green.
that's certainly a very interesting description.
But when I finally talked to you very briefly, just to make sure our connection worked, you sounded very unlike the sort of person I thought who might write this book. You sound very comfortable, relaxed, and like a very pleasant person. But
well, that's good to know.
But from everything I've heard, most of your work goes into the extreme black. And I've heard, when I first looked up Beyond Black, I thought you meant beyond black comedy. Later on, I discovered that you were referring to the world beyond death, or maybe even beyond that.
Well, I think it means both, really. I think Beyond Black describes the content of the book, and it also describes the manner of the book, because the comedy I'm deploying is very, very much on the edge. It certainly is on the edge of what you might term a good taste, and it certainly pushes the reader into some very macabre territory.
But you do it so deftly and with such complete control of your materials. You're basically moving between the minds of the two main women and the various, you could either call them spirits or fiends that assail them. And you go through tape recordings, you go into memories, you go into conversations, and it just clunks together like a jigsaw puzzle.
Well, I mean, what I'm trying to do is to get a movement between the inner world and the outer world. I wanted to know what the inner world of someone like the main character could possibly be like, because Alison earns her living as a psychic. She earns her living by talking to the dead. And I wanted to try and form some notion about what the interior life might be like if you were such a person. But I also wanted to locate the characters in a very specific external milieu. And what I chose was Southern England here and now.
And why is that? That's not where you grew up. You grew up farther north in England.
I did grow up in the north of England, but I've been living in the south for 20 years now. I'm not sure I'm entirely at home here yet, but I have to say that I probably am a southerner. Certainly, if I went back to the north of England, they'd think I was a southerner.
And do you find it as ghastly as you describe it?
In many ways, certainly just the spot I live on is very pleasant, very green, very comfortable, very safe environment. But you're conscious that you're in this little protected spot, and outside it, there's the motorway, there are the arterial roads, there are the sort of artificial communities planted around the arterial roads, places where people don't really live. They just go home and sleep in them and then commute to work somewhere else. And all these communities are artificial. They're places that nobody really comes from. Nobody has roots there. And I think it's very much a feature of life in this part of England that the link between individual memory and the landscape has been cut. People are rootless. And there's a complete lack of community. And it's this feeling, together with the pressing overpopulation, that I was trying to get hold of in the book.
As a sort of unstoppably cheerful American, I couldn't completely identify with this area, although the social factors that are going on in the southern England you describe are pretty much the same as they are here. I realized at a certain point there was, in the time of England's imperial greatness, there was maybe a forced but a certainly felt continuity between the medieval merry old England and the soldiers and sailors who went out to conquer the world. But I get the feeling that since World War II, that's all snapped, and that the technological progress in England is just as great as it is in the U.S., but it doesn't seem to connect the way it once did.
Yes, I think that because we do have this huge weighting of the population towards the southeast, which is also the most prosperous area, it makes for a kind of unbalance in national life. And round about where I live, which is about 25 miles outside central London, in relatively pleasant and prosperous area, what you notice as you drive about is they're always building some new superstore. And you drive past this place and you think, but we've already got six of those within a couple of miles, so who's going to shop there? And then a few months later you drive by and the car park is absolutely jammed with cars. And you think, where did all these people come from? And you have the uncanny sense that they're not so much being born as just springing fully grown out of the ground, ready to shop. And it is kind of alarming sensation, because you think, how many more people can this little place hold? And how much more shopping can we possibly do? I make this point about shopping because it does seem to be the great obsession and leisure pursuit of everyone around this area. And it seems it's replaced... well, what has it replaced? Going to the pub, going to church, playing sports, weekends are devoted to shopping. And I wanted, when I described Alison's physical milieu, the people she works amongst, I wanted to get something of this society over.
Well, certainly her assistant, partner, manager, Colette, is like that. All of the psychics she works with are like that, but she isn't. So you've developed a character who's very un-at home in this world.
Well, I think that the point is that Alison's clients are avid consumers of her services, even though her services are spiritual ones, but they go shopping for them in just the same way. And the satisfaction level, it probably lasts just as little while. Alison is rather distinct from her psychic colleagues because, for one thing, she has the most impressive talent, and the other psychics bear witness to her talent. What they think is, well, I sometimes cheat, but Alison, she doesn't cheat. She's the real thing. Now, what we find when we go into the book, I take you back to Alison's childhood, and we see how she first became involved with the spirits who now inhabit her. When I go out and watch mediums performing or psychics performing on stage, they always tend to say, I hooked up with my spirit guide when I was very young. And they always describe this as a kind of joyful experience. And their spirit guide is always a wise and wonderful dead person. And, of course, it occurred to me, What if this is not so? What if they're lying? What if they're standing on stage, putting over a version of their reality which is designed not to shock their audiences? So when Alison goes on stage, she's deliberately bland. She tells her audiences that life after death is just like a picnic in the park. But what she knows privately is something very different. She knows the world of the dead to be a harrowing, bleak, and confused world with a lot of people wandering around not knowing they're dead, looking for the places they used to live and the factories they used to work at. So there's a complete split between what she believes herself and what she tells the paying public.
Toward the end of the book, Mrs. Etchells, her mentor at one time,
yes.
After she dies, Allison connects with her and asks, what's it like in spirit? And she says, Aldershot. It's like,
yes,
Aldershot?
Aldershot's the town where Allison grew up. It's it's an army town. And Allison's mother was a prostitute. And she expected Allison to follow her into the trade. And when this old lady finally goes over and she communicates from the beyond, what she's saying is, actually, over here is just like back there. And when you move into spirit world, you just go on doing what you were always doing. You don't get wise, you don't get good, you don't get helpful to the people who are still alive. If you were a mean and nasty and bad person when you were alive, you just carry on like that in spirit world. So it's an extraordinarily bleak vision of the afterlife, and it's very different from the one that Alison peddles to her audiences.
How similar is it to what you encountered as a girl? I haven't read your memoir, Giving Up the Ghost, but I've seen this paragraph quoted about seeing the devil in the weeds behind your back fence when you were, I guess, 5, 7. And it says, it is as high as a child of 2. Its depth is 1 foot, 15 inches. The air stirs around it invisibly. I am cold and rinsed by nausea. I cannot move. It has no edges, no mass, no dimension, no shape except the formless. It moves. I beg it, stay away, stay away. Within the space of a thought, it is inside me and has set up a sick resonance within my bones and in all the cavities of my body.
Yes.
I assume that Allison reflects a lot of your own experiences.
Well, I think this particular and quite singular experience was something that shaped my whole childhood. And what I've given on the page in my memoir, Giving Up the Ghost, is as accurate a description as I can of this strange phenomena, which I have to say I witnessed, but I cannot say I saw or heard it. But what seemed to manifest itself was a kind of distillation of evil. I don't call it the devil, and I didn't call it the devil then, but what I witnessed purely accidentally seemed to me to be something extremely powerful, devastatingly powerful, and actively malevolent. And when I witnessed it, I can say it seemed to have shape and dimension, but it seemed to have no form as such. It was almost like looking at a spot in the empty air and seeing evil formed up. Now, when I wrote Beyond Black, I put in a passage concerning Allison's childhood, which is a kind of parallel passage to my own experience. And in Allison's life, it's a crucial point, because it is on that day that her spirit guide first enters into her, if you like. She's playing at the back of her house where there is waste ground. And she sees some men going in and out of the outbuildings that are there. She thinks they're men she knows, so she waves to them. But they don't wave back. And the next moment she thinks, perhaps I don't know them at all. And the men are carrying boxes, and they're passing them to each other. And she has a sensation that what is in the boxes is something very dreadful. She knows it for a second. She knows what it is. And then the knowledge slips away from her. And she feels cold and she feels very ill. She knows she's witnessed something that she shouldn't have witnessed. she goes into the house and she looks at herself in the mirror. But what she sees is not her own face, but it's the face of a man called Maurice Warren. And Maurice has come into the house behind her. He's standing behind her. And he seems to be replacing her own body. Now, later, Maurice Warren will become her spirit guide. He's an evil, squalid, gruesome little man. Nothing like the wise and lovely spirit guides that other mediums claim they have. But on that day, when she's seven or so, he seems to slide inside her body and take possession of her. And the whole book is about her battle to expel Maurice and make a kind of life without him, whilst at the same time he is threatening to drag her into his own hellish world.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, talking with Hilary Mantel, author most recently of Beyond Black. In the book, Allison does succeed in expelling Morris for a while, but then he comes back with a vengeance, and facts about her childhood that she'd vaguely remembered suddenly become hideously clear. Although even then, the exact details and agency of some of the worst of them is still, will probably never be known. But then at the end, she all through the novel, she's trying to do a good action, and she hopes that this might get her away from Morris. And in the end, she suddenly does expel all the fiends and winds up with two nice little old lady spirit guides in the back of her car.
Yes, that's right.
That's the one part that wasn't quite believable, because it's certainly what I hoped would happen to her, but I had a feeling that the novel would end as gruesomely as it proceeded.
Well, I want to leave my reader with some chink of hope, you see. Just a little prospect that there may be some redemption in Alison's life. After all, I think I've put her through quite enough by that stage.
I think you have. And I was dreading the end and being a bit of a wishy-washy person, wimpy person, I was glad to have that bit of solace.
I think she's still pursuing her trade, and we know that being a medium takes a great toll on her physically, mentally, in every way. So it's not as if she's being reborn into some new life, because I think that would be unrealistic, but she has managed to get Maurice Warren and his evil friends off her back.
From what I've read, and I haven't read any of your other novels, they cover quite a ground. Although some of these themes keep coming up, but you've written about the French Revolution, you've written about South African country.
I've written a book called A Change of Climate, which is set partly in South Africa at the end of the 1950s, and partly in what was then Bechuanaland, which is now Botswana, back in that era.
And now
I lived in Africa myself in the late 70s and early 80s, and I do hope to write about that in a future novel, to write about Botswana at the time when I was living there. But in A Change of Climate, I chose to go back to those years in South Africa where the apartheid system was setting into place.
In, I guess, your first novel was a historical novel about the French Revolution, especially Danton, Robespierre, and Desmoulins. And your latest novel, The Woman Who Died of Robespierre, is about a woman who wrote a novel about Robespierre.
Actually, that's a book that's work in progress.
Oh, okay.
It's not a novel.
Oh, interesting. It has another woman's name as the main character.
It's not a novel. It's a kind of study or memoir, if you like, of the Polish playwright Stanisława Przybyszewska, who wrote a number of plays about the French Revolution. And I want to explore through that book something of her own life, which was a very strange one, and also something about, I want to say something about how we have remembered the revolution, and also something about history and fiction. But that book's a little way down the line yet.
Okay, I checked a website that listed it as being from 2006.
Yeah, that's not going to happen now. I am writing another historical novel, and I think that probably once I've written another historical novel myself, I would be better equipped to consider the matter of history and fiction. I have written, as you say, A Place of Greater Safety, which is about the French Revolution, which was the first novel I wrote, but not the first I published. And I've also written a novel called The Giant O'Brien, which is a story based on the story of a real-life Irish giant who came to London in the 1780s to exhibit himself as a freak. And now I'm engaged on a novel set in England in the 16th century. So by the time I've finished my current book, I'll have earned my credentials, if you like, as a historical novelist, and I'll be able to stand back and give consideration to the form and how historical fiction has changed over the years, and simply why one does it. Why one tries to engage with the past in this way, and what a novelist can do that historians can't.
And
so those are some of the questions I want to explore in that little book when I get to it. But I've got quite a lot of projects stacked up at the moment.
And this almost seems like a sacrilegious question, because when I was reading Beyond Black, the world was so, it portrays was so totally convincing that I didn't want to ask you how you wrote black comedy or if you saw the world this bleakly. But you've been so forthcoming that I want to know, are your historical novels as much ghastly comedy as your contemporary ones?
Well, I do tend to see the world in these terms. I mean, I suppose I have a strong streak of the macabre, but I think it's also something to do with the part of the country I come from. It tends to be the kind of humor, that sense of humor that people have. And I'm usually able to see the black side of things, and usually able to see the funny side. And I think that, although, of course, one doesn't set out to write a comic novel about the French Revolution, you have to realize that the French didn't stop laughing on the day the Bastille fell. My novel, The Giant O'Brien, is, I hope, very funny, as well as being profoundly sad. And I like to see, now how can I put it? I like to look for all the potential in situations, rather than say, this is a straight up serious kind of novel, there is no room for jokes. But I suppose what I'm trading on in the historical novels is more a sense of sly irony and mordant comedy, and also the sort of worldly wise, almost cynical comedy that's generated by very articulate people, and particularly very articulate people in politics.
Well, thanks very much, Hilary Mantel. I enjoyed Beyond Black immensely.
Thanks.
And immensely more than I expected to, and I'll be looking forward to your other books.
Thank you very much.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've got with me Molly Fisk. Molly!
Hello, Eric.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
It's been a long time since you've been on here, and we miss you.
I miss you, too.
But you're here not to be part of the show. We'll have to, not to be part of my side of the show. You're here because you've got a show of your own.
Exactly. It's a show on June 1st, and sponsored by and formerly at the Bookseller. But now we've moved it over to the Center for the Arts off-center stage. And it's a poetry reading. I'll be reading with two friends, one I've met in person and one I have not, coming from very far away. Rin Williams, who's coming from Brooklyn, New York, and Jane Hilberry, who's coming from Colorado Springs.
Okay, and I'm thinking we should have both of them, but only one light is on, so I'm going to push that one. Hi, is this Rin? Hi, Rin, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, I may have disconnected Jane, so I'm going to try to get her again. And Molly, why don't you and the two of you talk for a minute?
Okay.
Molly knows how to do this.
Hello,
hi.
Rin, how are you?
Hi.
So you are coming to town to read from your new book, Adonis Garage.
Yes.
And Eric's making phone noises. Want to read a poem from it? Rin? I think we have had a small telephone shenanigan that has happened, and Eric is looking to fix it. While he's doing all those things, I'll read you a poem. First, I'll tell you a little bit, though. These are women I have worked with in a workshop that I do online. I've met about 400 people doing this workshop, and they are two wonderful poets. They'll be coming to town. We're doing a tiny little book tour, Grass Valley, Pleasanton, and Berkeley. And then they'll fly home again. And we would like to have you all come and listen to us. This is a poem called Belonging. Long after I'd remembered most of it, after my mother had said, "You've wrecked my life," and Ellen asked me not to send her the poems because they ruined her sex life, and Tom wondered aloud if I was recalling a past life. After Nan said over the phone, "By the way, I don't believe you," and Henry told some of my friends at dinner that I'd always been a liar. After I'd gained 100 pounds and begun to carry it like an open window, and after enough time had passed to dull my anger down to a simmer, I walked to the kitchen one day, a sunny day, a Tuesday, heading for Haagen-Dazs or Ben and Jerry's, and caught my face in the mirror unawares, the rosy cheeks, slight clench in the jaw, and looked back at myself directly with my father's eyes, the purpose in them clear, all the power he carried toward my bed that I was bearing in the direction of ice cream. And I understood how humans do what they do, how they can't not do it. And at that moment, I loved my father, both the dangerous and the helpless, and was surprised at loving him again.
Very nice. I think we have Rin and Jane back on. Are you there?
I'm here. Rin's here.
They're both here.
Jane
great.
Is here.
Okay. Molly, you know them much better than I do. Do you want to begin the conversation?
Well, are you copping out, Eric?
I don't have to. I can just tell you I have your books in my hands, Body Painting by Jane, which is a Red Hen Press book, and Adonis Garage by Rin, Prairie Schooner, it won the Prairie Schooner Book Prize in Poetry and is published by University of Nebraska Press. And I've read about three poems from each one and found them. Actually, I found the three of you incredibly compatible. I'm assuming that's why you're friends.
Probably, although I think we surprise each other. We met in a workshop, so we haven't sat around and hung out together. This is going to be the first time. Yeah.
This will be the first time we've read together, so we'll have to see how that goes.
But you all write poems that deal with states of mind and with very minute observation of the details around you when you're either observing something or recollecting it.
Mm-hmm. That sounds right.
And in that regard, I think you would all fit together very well. It's not as we're not going to have any rap poetry in this reading.
Not this
probably
time.
Not.
I don't think any of us are language poets. Probably.
That's a safe guess.
So I'd just like to find out a little bit about each of you. I'll start with Rin, because yours is the book I just picked up. Huh. And a minute ago, I picked up Jane's first. How did you get to writing poetry, and how did you get to the style you've developed?
Well, I've lived in New York all my life, and I think New York has sort of imprinted itself on my work pretty strongly. It's something that I mean to write about, but it just sort of has wormed its way into a lot of my writing, it seems. I've written, you know, ever since I was very young, and I had a journalism major, but realized very early on that I never read anything but poetry, so what was I doing writing magazine articles? I had no use for magazines, and I didn't really care much about them. I only did that because people told me you had to make a living somehow. And but that didn't really work out very well.
You may not be a language poet, but you're a sonic one, and you don't even know what you sound like to us. We're getting very strange
echoes.
Sounds, echoes, and reverberations, and distortions, and it sounds like you're talking through a concertina
chamber.
Or something like
or
that.
Or that David Byrne had something to do with this broadcast.
Yes. Well, maybe I'll cut it short then. But I'm really looking forward to being out in California and reading. I don't know. I haven't been in California very much, and where I've been most is in Southern California. So I'm looking forward to reading out there and getting to know that area. And that's all I can say. I don't know.
Yeah. Now, I know that the three of you are going to be reading at another very significant occasion. Are you actually making the rounds together, or do you just have the two events?
We've actually got three events. Two of them are on Sunday, one a reading in Pleasanton at Century House and in the afternoon, and then we're doing the Cody's reading in the evening.
And that's a significant one that I'd like to talk about a little later. Mm-hmm. But first, let's see what Jane's voice sounds like.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, you're there, and you don't have... Oh. How boring.
David Byrne
is
not...
I don't have an echo chamber.
You don't have an echo chamber. You don't have any sounds.
Oh, no. Okay.
Can we talk to Rin again?
No.
So, Jane, tell us a little bit about your work and how you got into it.
I started writing when I was a teenager, and my father is actually a poet as well, Conrad Hilberry, and a big part of my sort of connection with him when I was growing up was through poetry. So when I was way too young to know anything about poetry, he would show me something he was working on, say, well, what do you think about this? So it got me thinking about craft in a way that I probably wouldn't have done normally at that point in my life. And so that was a great gift that I got from my father. And the sort of challenge that accompanied that was that it took me a long time to figure out really what was my own voice and my own style, as distinct from my father's way of writing and perceiving things. So that was, I think, you know, that was part of my introduction to poetry. And I think the other impulse that I had to write was that I had a sister who died when I was very young, and it wasn't talked about much in my family. That was sort of the 50s way of doing things, is you just didn't talk about it. And I had some need, I think, to make that real. So I started writing about that experience and about her death as a way to give it some kind of emotional concreteness. And I still really am a firm believer in the power of poetry to transform experience. So you can take something that's originally a very painful experience, and by finding a way to express it and finding a form for it, you can actually change its quality somewhat in your life.
And having had poetry in your family may give it an extra dimension. I'm looking at Rin's, some poems from Adonis Garage. They're very, very direct. Drag empresses in the powder room raged is the beginning line of Adonis Garage. And mm-hmm. Immortality begins, who first suggested Bernie's on 6th Avenue for nitrous oxide? Mm-hmm. Whereas several of yours are Crazy Jane poems, which
right.
I assume is Yeats's Crazy Jane.
Right. My Crazy Jane is different than Yeats's, and I tried for a long time to try to find another name for her because I thought I don't want to invite comparisons to Yeats. That's just not a smart thing to do as a poet. But she's sort of an alter ego of mine, and that was really the only name that ultimately seemed to serve. But yeah, she's sort of the wilder part of myself that gets to step up and speak in poems.
You even have one of them, Crazy Jane Talks with the Bones, and I almost think of John Berryman's Mr. Bones.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Although I haven't read the poem yet. I just looked at the title.
Yeah, that's a good connection.
And your poems tend to begin more generally, more abstractly, mm-hmm. like, I don't want to sleep with truth or beauty, just mm-hmm. want the life that other women have. And they start more with a thought, and Rin start more with a location.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yep, I think that's true.
And where do these thoughts come from?
I don't know. I mean, that's the great thing about poetry, is I think you never know what you're going to say when you sit down to write a poem. For me, I tend to write a lot, and then every once in a while something starts to happen, but I never sit down with an idea of what I'm going to write about or a thought about what I'm going to write about. It has to kind of arise by itself.
Well, I think there are some people that actually do sit down with a thought. I'm always mystified. I have friends that actually do know. They sit down and they, you know, they've been thinking about something for a long time, and they will actually sit down and they, you know, they've been pondering over something, and they'll sit down. I'm not of that.
Yeah, it sounds
at all.
Like you don't work that way either.
No, I sort of don't know what I'm thinking. I don't even know what's going on in my life until I write it first.
That's one of the great
gifts of writing.
Exactly, is that element of discovery.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now that we've got Rin's voice sort of de-echoed, I'd like to hear a poem from each of you, some idea of what we're going to see this coming weekend.
Good. Rin, do you want to read first?
Okay, if my voice is normal enough.
Your voice is suddenly very normal.
Right.
We're sort of desolate, but we can handle it.
Okay. I'll read Arc of Desire. It was a kid in the Bronx, barely a teenager, up around Grand Concourse near Yankee Stadium. His friends said he was stoned, that they were all up there on a roof, really fucked up, crouched in a corner out of the wind. It was early spring. Maybe he started it all on a dare. Maybe he stood up on the edge of the building just to show how cool he was, taking his shirt and pants off first, as if there was no chill to the air. Maybe it was the smoke held tight in his lungs, that throbbing and the way it went shivering out through his chest and shoulders, that made him want to tear all his clothes off and throw himself into the sun like Icarus, exploding over the side of the building in a wild arc of desire, eyes fully open, chest bare, and arms flung back like wings. It must have been one of those days in March when there are buds on the vines and a light touch of green just outside the window. There's a breeze and a flat wave of sun on the brick. You can see all the different shades, red and black, the gray and the yellow, and you want to put your skin against them, brick as warm as an oven you'd slide loaves into with giant paddles, a kind of wanting your whole body has, yeast and flour, the heat and the scent. You can taste the bread, feel the shape in your hands. But then, being March, cold as a slap, a door opens, wind brings water to your eyes, breath punched from your gut. Like the time I was working in the museum with the architectural photographer. He wasn't tall, very quiet and slender. I didn't even realize at first I was looking at the way his trousers hung, the way his shirt fell away from his throat, and the shadow that was left at the collarbone, right at the base where the soft hair was. And all of a sudden, there's this warmth going through me. I felt my nude body on the granite slab next to Lachaise's great bare-breasted woman with the wishing pond and the pennies glinting, light sifting down through the leaves in patches, a complete universe in every flicker, like when there's a partial eclipse and through each tiny pinhole in a piece of cardboard, you can see the sun, the moon, and its delicious crescent dancing in a twilight fleeting equilibrium. Two bodies, light and dark, pressed together. But the cold of the huge, cold moon passed over, came up to meet me, right in the face, rude as a sidewalk. I'm a married woman. I could taste the chill of the granite, like the bitter aluminum you get in your mouth when you trip badly or almost get smashed by a car. Fear surges up in a flood, and you gulp it back to that dark place. I've read how in medieval times people would throw themselves from cliffs when the light waned, how they saw the moon cutting the sphere, that dark outline moving slowly over gold, and there was nothing left for them, no illusion of life anymore. Consumed with yearning, they felt the last long kiss of sun on their skin as they raised their arms and they fell.
Ooh.
That was great. Thank you, Rin.
And Jane, do you have something?
Yes, I do. Maybe I'll read something that's also about desire, but in a totally different tone. This is called Train Whistle. I wake up to my lover on the phone, singing his repertoire of train songs. He does an impressive train whistle, mixing it liberally into every song. His favorite is the one his father sang, about not using the bathroom while the train is in the station. It's set to the tune of the humoresque and moves abruptly from toilet etiquette to a conclusive, I love you. I'm glad to be serenaded out of sleep, humored into the day's happiness by my exuberant lover, who might be unhappy if he could manage to care about what's past. I haul my past with me like a freight train. It's how I know that I am real. When I pull forward, something resists. But this morning, I'm still in bed, and my hips begin to sway, my whole body humming, the way a train does after the engine starts up. And my lover, like an unruly passenger, is singing his train songs to get the day moving, making his very impressive whistle sound at every chance. That's it.
Yum.
Yep. And I know that. Passengers will please refrain.
Exactly.
From flushing toilets while the train is standing in the station. I won't. Obviously sing it. It's too late. But I learned that not from my lover, but my mother.
Yeah, that's funny. I didn't, I'd never heard it before, but somebody else told me about this song, and it sounds very charming.
Oh, you didn't have my mother. So we've got to get out of here pretty quickly to make way for Jimmy Accardi, but Molly, once more, and I said this weekend, but it's really this Thursday.
It's this Thursday at 6:30 at the Center for the Arts' off-center stage. It's sponsored by the bookseller, but we wanted a place that was slightly bigger. And it's Rin Williams coming from Brooklyn, New York, Jane Hilbury coming from Colorado Springs, and me coming from Upper Newtown Road. And we hope you will join us. Admission is free. and the time is again 6:30.
And we've got to say very quickly, you've got two more readings, and the last of them is going to be in Berkeley at Cody's, and you're going to be the last people to read there?
We are going to be the last people to read at Cody's.
How depressing.
They are closing. We're reading on Sunday, June 4th at 7:30, and the store is closing its doors after 43 years on June 10th.
And this is part of the general decline of Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, because I guess the other two Cody's stores, the one on 4th Street in Berkeley and downtown San Francisco, are doing fine. But the one that
started
for all of us was the bookstore in Berkeley. When I got there in 1967 or 66, I guess it had been there 3 years, and I figured it would be there forever.
Yep.
It is sad.
Buy your books from a bookstore, everybody.
Okay, last time, Molly, Jane, and Rin will be at Off-Center Stage this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. So come and give them a listen.
Thanks so much, Eric.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks. And now, this has been Booktown from KVMR-FM in Nevada City. Stay tuned to Jimmy Icardi's Rock and Roll Party.